Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another APS Portfolio Strategy Call. The topic today, Omicron and its implications for the economy and markets. I'm Steve Abrahams, Head of Investment Strategy here at Amherst Pierpont. So news of the new Omicron variant of COVID-19 really started breaking the weekend before Thanksgiving. How's that for a holiday? And the market has clearly responded. Rates have repriced lower, certainly in the intermediate and long end of the yield curve. Volatility is up in rates and equities. Spreads are wider pretty much wherever you look. And all of this is happening with very little actually known about Omicron and its implications for growth, inflation, or the Fed. Luckily, we have two excellent guests today that can fill in a lot of the details of what is known scientifically about Omicron, what Omicron might indicate about the future variants, the risk of future variants, and the economic implications of all of this. We will hear from Stephanie H. Factor, MD. She's an associate professor of medicine and infectious diseases at the Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. She's done work on respiratory illness at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and for the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. We'll also hear from Stephen Stanley, as many of you know, chief economist here at Amherst Pierpont and the author of the regular coronavirus update, Virus Policy and the Economy, which has been coming out since the start of the pandemic and has been become one of the must-reads on pandemic and its policy and economic impact. So we're going to try to cover the topic over the next 30 minutes or so and then open the call to questions from the audience. You should see on the right side of your webinar screen a chat box. You'll be able to use that where you can write and submit questions. And as you submit questions, I will relay them to the panel. You can submit a question at any time during the discussion, so whenever the spirit strikes. But by and large, we're going to turn to audience questions only after the initial discussion has wrapped up. There will be no additional slides, so keep your ears tuned. That's where all the good information is going to come from. So we might as well jump right into this, and Dr. Factor, I'm going to start with you and really go to the questions that I suspect are most top of mind, and those are, what do we know scientifically about Omicron spread, the severity of the disease, and at this point, the efficacy of current vaccination?
Thank you so much for having me, Steve. All right, so here's what we know about Omicron. We know that it spreads faster than the other variants. Everybody's seen that in the news. The thing that the news has been talking about recently has been the fact that it appears to be associated with less severe disease. There seems to be fewer hospitalizations and fewer deaths so far. But I want to tell you why that is absolutely inconclusive information, and here is why. Omicron started in South Africa, as everyone knows. And as you know, South Africa right now is having their summer. We're having our winter, obviously. Coronaviruses in general, even if you catch them, even if it's the same organism, if you catch them in the summer versus catching them in the winter, they cause more severe disease in the winter. So that is one of the reasons why nobody is saying that what we know so far is definitive. The other thing that that's really important about South Africa versus here is that the population structure of South Africa is different. It's a developing country. It has many more people in the younger age groups than we do. And so it is much more likely that it's younger people who are getting infected there. And as you know, younger people do better in general. So I hate to say it, but we do not know at all yet whether this variant is going to cause less severe disease for anybody, I'm hoping. But that's pretty much what we know.
And what can we say at this point about efficacy of existing vaccines?
Okay, so, of course, that's what everybody wants to know. And as of about 7 this morning, we can say nothing. The one thing that people have said that they think it's going to be efficacious, but I have not seen really good data on that. I will check again before the end of this phone call. The one thing that we do know is that prior infection does not appear to be protective against developing disease from Omicron.
Just quickly, what's the basis for drawing that conclusion? Presumably, we're seeing infections in people that have had prior illness.
Yes, exactly, and at a pretty high rate. So it does not appear as though it's protective.
Okay, so that's the state of the science, at least at this point. How about timelines for getting to some kind of definitive answer on any of these issues? Spread, I don't know if we're definitive. Severity, obviously, and efficacy still seem like they're pretty wide open.
Pretty wide open, exactly. Okay, so just to remind you all with what we saw with each of the waves that we've seen, usually what happens is people will acquire the infection, and then in about a little bit more than a week, between 1 and 2 weeks, that's when we see people going into the hospital because they have severe disease. And then we usually see deaths about 2 to 3 weeks later. The amount of people with the Omicron variant is still kind of small so far. So I don't know that we're going to have a definitive answer about the severity of disease for a few weeks. Like, my bet would be that we will start seeing Omicron hospitalizations here at Sinai towards the beginning to end of next week, but I don't think it'll really give us a complete picture for a few more weeks.
And okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, the other thing I was going to say was this. You know, what we'll do is we'll see who shows up in the hospital. We'll see their age. We'll see underlying conditions that they have. And the other thing that we will see at that time is we will see whether or not they've been vaccinated. And from that, I think that we will learn a good deal about how severe the disease is and whether or not the virus is efficacious.
So, okay, so we clearly don't have definitive answers, and there's obviously a timeline for some of the key issues. Is there anything that the scientific community can say at this point about, let's say, the range of plausible outcomes on, let's say, severity or efficacy?
All right, so I'm just going to draw an analogy for you to the flu for a second. So, you know, what happens when we have the flu vaccine, and you guys know this, that the flu vaccine, the makeup of the flu vaccine is changed every season. And it's changed every season because the flu virus changes. It's really bad at replicating itself. It doesn't, it's nowhere near as rigid as we are genetically, and doesn't, you know, well replicate itself. So it makes a lot of mistakes. So it changes from year to year. And what happens often is we will get the flu vaccine, which is made about six to eight months before the flu season. And by then, the flu has mutated somewhat. And so the flu vaccine ends up not being a perfect match, but it ends up being somewhat protective. We always refer to it as cross-reactivity. So the idea is it doesn't protect you completely, but if you've gotten the vaccine, you'll have less severe disease than had you not had the vaccine. I think that everyone's hoping that the current vaccines will be completely protective against the new variants. But I think that, in the kind of mid-case scenario is that it won't be perfectly protective, but it will give you some cross-reactivity. So you're far less likely to get a severe infection than you would be without the vaccine. you know, at the horrible end would be the vaccines aren't protective at all. Nobody is saying anything about this. You know, you and I talked about this before. I don't think anybody is saying anything about this because nobody wants to be wrong in the long term. My bet would be that it's got to offer some protective immunity, but I can't say that it's going to be complete.
Okay, and so, I mean, just thinking for a moment about how well the scientific community is set up to actually get to definitive answers, I mean, what are the resources that are getting put against nailing those questions down at this point?
All right, so several. First of all, as you would imagine, I mean, every healthcare system itself is carefully watching every single admission for Omicron. So, I mean, they're carefully watching every admission for COVID, and they are the ones that have the ability to are doing the genetic testing so that they could quickly identify whether it's Omicron versus Delta versus Alpha versus something new. And as you can also imagine, everybody is dying to be the first to answer these questions. So my bet is that you will start seeing reports, you know, in 2 to 3 weeks about what people are seeing in the hospitals. In addition to that, CDC is, you know, they're conducting, I think it's like bi-daily calls where they're speaking to all the hospitals to find out the numbers that they're seeing, find out how many people who are coming into the hospital have which variants and how many of each variant are vaccinated versus unvaccinated. So that's kind of what's going on right now within the healthcare system officially, right? But then you have places like Johns Hopkins, which posts data, you know, as it shows up. And as you can imagine, the Europeans, who are a little bit before us in terms of this variant, should also be releasing information over the next few weeks. I can't promise you how great it will be, but over the next few weeks, we will be seeing a lot more information.
So a little bit of a question around distinguishing Omicron from Delta and other variants. I guess I'm curious, we're starting to detect Omicron, but can people get multiple variants at the same time? And could that cloud the signal about Omicron and some of its implications?
All right, so that is a brilliant question. Can people get more than one variant at the same time? And the answer is there is no reason why they couldn't. And as you all know, you know, one infection is often a setup for others. So there's no reason why you couldn't get both. But so far I haven't seen it. The signal, so just to be clear, the PCR test that's done does help you identify which variant it is. It can. That technique is used for variant identification. Often, PCR tests are just done to identify a very small portion of the genetic code, but you can do PCR to identify the full genetic code. And so if you are doing genetic analyses, you would definitely be able, appropriately, you're doing appropriate genetic analyses, you would definitely be able to identify all the variants in an individual. And so I would not expect it to cloud the data very much. I don't think that infection with two variants at the same time is going to be common. I think it probably will occur, but I don't think it's going to be common enough to cloud the data.
Got it. Okay. All right. Well, let me turn for a moment then to the economy. I mean, this seems to be at least the current state of knowledge. And let me pull Stephen Stanley into this discussion. And I guess the first question for Stephen would be whether, in your estimation, Omicron has already had any kind of impact on the economy.
Hi, Steve. Good afternoon, everyone. I would say not much yet, and I think the reason is partly because of where we are in this pandemic. People have gotten, with each successive wave, people have gotten a little more used to living with the pandemic and are at the margin at least more willing to kind of move on with their lives even in the face of a new risk. So there certainly were a lot of news headlines around Omicron over the last week or so, but there hasn't been much obvious change, I think, in how people are actually behaving just yet, other than I'm going to guess that this is going to lead to a rush of people wanting to go out and get vaccinated, which is a good thing in the long run. I would also say that as Dr. Factor discussed with the medical data, the reality is the economic data does tend to lag somewhat as well. So we're just starting to get data for November right now, and it's going to be a month before we start to see really solid data for December. Now, there are plenty of high-frequency indicators that will, that will give us some lead insight into what's going on. You know, the high frequency indicators for the retail sector, especially during the holiday season. We can watch, the daily data on restaurant bookings and airline passengers and other things to get a sense. But so far, there really hasn't been evidence of a significant change in economic activity, at least so far.
Well, how about the Fed's equation? Is it on their radar? And how do you think somebody sitting at the FOMC table is possibly thinking about this?
Right. So the Fed's typical mode of operation when faced with a new uncertainty like this is to freeze, almost like a deer in the headlights, and to say we're not going to do anything for a meeting or two or a month or two or whatever the case may be until we get our hands around this. And that's kind of how I thought the Fed would approach this Omicron situation initially when we heard the news over the Thanksgiving weekend. And Chairman Powell, of course, testified in front of Congress last week, and I was surprised at the fact that while he certainly acknowledged the risk that Omicron presents, the uncertainty that it raises, it seemed to me that the Fed is willing to kind of go about its business and assume that this is not going to lead to a big disruption in the trajectory of the economy until proven otherwise. So, he laid out the possibility of accelerating tapering, which of course is the policy step that's on the table for the next meeting. And he didn't really seem all that fazed by Omicron, which, as I said, I'm a little surprised by, but I think the bottom line here is that with inflation having accelerated the way that it has, the Fed is increasingly recognizing that it's behind the curve, and I think it's prepared to, at a minimum, to try to wrap up asset purchases as quickly as possible. Now, if Omicron ends up being a much more significant issue for the economy than the initial read, then they can always come back and change. But it does seem to me that at a minimum they'd like to get the asset purchases wrapped up as soon as possible, and that seems to be relatively independent on the near-term course of the pandemic.
So you're making an interesting point, and I know from my chair it's been interesting to see the way that the market seems to be reacting to Omicron, although it's a noisy comparison, obviously. But, since the news started coming out the weekend before Thanksgiving, the curve has really dramatically flattened. It's difficult to say whether it's been a bear flattening or a bull flattening, but we have seen short rates in general move up, longer rates come down. It was interesting to see what was happening in the part of the curve that's probably most sensitive to the Fed, which arguably is the two-year note. Originally, yields there dropped after the Omicron news started to break, but then when Powell came out and was so hawkish in his testimony to Congress, we saw two-year rates begin to go back up, and since then we've seen not just the two-year part of the curve, but longer maturities start to rise as well. So one clear thing we've seen is this clear rate move, although it's mixed up with what we're seeing the Fed do as well. Volatility is clearly up, realized volatility, implied volatility in the VIX or in short-dated options in the MOVE Index, but even longer-dated options have gone up. So clearly the market, in part through Omicron, arguably other things, is now entertaining a much wider set of market outcomes over the various expiries that are out there. And we've seen, with a flatter curve, higher volatility, credit spreads softer and mortgage spreads have been much wider. So even though I know the scientific community is still trying to figure this out and the Fed is proceeding by and large on its prior path, the markets have had to figure out what it wants to do even in advance of any kind of definitive answers there. So let me kind of turn back towards, I guess, the science, because at this point, I think we know that the coronavirus obviously mutates, but I'm going to ask you, Dr. Factor, what are the ways that it's likely that the virus is going to mutate going forward, and what are the odds that we're going to continue to see a series of new variants emerge?
All right. So just to start the conversation about this, I just want to remind you of three different qualities of viruses, right? One is how infective they are, meaning how of everybody who is exposed to it, how likely are you to get infected? What percentage of people who get exposed actually get infected? Then the next question, the next issue is how likely is it to cause symptoms, right? Of those who get the infection, how many of them can get sick in any level? And then the next one is severity. Of those who get sick, how many of them are hospitalized and or die, right? How severe is the disease? So the coronavirus, since it is rapidly multiplying in any individual who has it, it is likely to multiply. As it multiplies, it is likely to develop mutations, right? And so the more time that it has to multiply, the more time it has to mutate. And obviously, the number of people with it just increases. The more people who have it, the more opportunity it has to multiply and divide, and the longer that people have it for, the more opportunity it has to multiply and mutate, right? So, yeah, we will absolutely continue to see all different types of mutations. The things that we worry about are, right, we worry that they're going to become far more transmissible, meaning, you know, that more people who are exposed will get it, that they will cause disease in more people, and they will come with more severe disease. But the mutations will happen in both directions. The mutations will absolutely, there will be strains of it that will be far less likely to spread. There will be strains that are far less likely to cause illness. There'll be strains that are far less likely to kill you. We're going to see those in both directions, and we're just going to continue to see them as long as a lot of people have the disease. I think that from a public health perspective, right, we're not going to get incredibly worried or nervous if we end up with strains that cause less disease and less severe illness, right? We get really nervous when we see something that's causing a lot more, in one of these three characteristics, right? A lot more people get sick, a lot more people die, et cetera.
So, I mean, if you're part of the infrastructure that's monitoring the public and monitoring for new variants, are there ways of basically placing your bets? I mean, are there places in particular or types of activities or types of populations where scientists are especially watching for new variants?
That's a great question. Okay, so the scientists everywhere are watching for new variants, basically because of the history we've gone through so far. This reminds me of a conversation that you and I had a little bit earlier. There are places in the world where diseases like this are likely to emerge, right? That's the thing. Where are new diseases like this likely to emerge? And they are likely to emerge in tropical areas where humans and animals are coming into contact in new ways that they haven't in the past. But for variants for this disease, now that it's widespread, are likely to occur wherever it is multiplying in large numbers of people.
Got it. Okay. So what would health policymakers have to do to try to reduce variant risk to some kind of tolerable level?
Right. Okay. So, you know, the way to reduce variants is to prevent infections, right? So that is why there's such a push for vaccination, appropriately so. But the fewer people who get infected and the less severe that their disease is, the less they're producing viruses, the less they're spreading them, right? So that's what you want. The big concern within the medical community, we did not talk about this, but one of the big concerns that I have, and I imagine many of my colleagues have, is with the oral medications are not as good for preventing variants as vaccines are, right? Because vaccines, we really believe, do prevent a lot of infection, and then, you know, they will make infection less severe. The thing about the oral variants is it doesn't prevent, it doesn't, like, stop the disease in its tracks. It's like people already have it. Then they get the medication. They may get better earlier, but it may not prevent them from spreading it at all, because as you know, the transmission occurs prior to getting symptoms, about 2 days before getting symptoms, up until, you know, as much as 14 days later, although the majority of infections are spread in the early period. If you start taking the medication doesn't work right away, and you could still spread it. So the real trick for preventing variants is to get the vaccinations out there to everybody and to encourage everyone we know to get vaccinated. That's why you're seeing all these messages.
Okay, so let me swing for a moment back to Stephen Stanley. Again, this is away from Omicron per se, but if we're looking at a future where we're going to continue seeing some ongoing string of COVID variants, what does that do to the economy, if anything?
Right. Well, as I mentioned, I think one thing that has been pretty clear, and Chairman Powell and others at the Fed have commented on it, particularly over the last few months, is that with each successive wave, the appetite for restrictions and therefore the propensity for the economy to weaken has been diminished in each case. So if we go back to the summer and the Delta wave, it was really the second largest in many states, the second largest wave of the pandemic behind last winter, and yet, you know, when you look at what happened with regard to the economy, we had a couple of months where the growth rate of GDP slowed. I mean, the Q3 GDP number was much lower. You had a couple of months where payroll growth slowed down considerably, but was still significant, especially after the revisions that we've seen in the past couple of months, which is a much different much different than what we saw last winter, when the economy really stalled out and in some, you know, it for some variables was actually contracting a little bit. And I think, you know, it looks like, unless we get kind of a worst case outcome on the public health front, my guess is that kind of gives you a general sense of how this might look. You know, best case scenario is that it's not as severe as some of the previous variants, and it just doesn't have quite the legs that we were initially afraid of. If it does, then I suspect we'll go through another wave. We'll have another couple of months where people will pull back to some degree. They won't do the things that, that are highest risk, travel and, going to places with big crowds like sporting events and amusement parks and whatnot. But the underlying economy should continue to grow in that event. So we could see another quarter or so of slowdown, but not necessarily a derailing of the underlying strength in the economy. The tricky part is for the Fed is that what we saw with the Delta wave is that, yes, it did weaken the economy for a time, but it also exacerbated inflation pressures. So the direction in which another variant wave might push Fed policy at the margin isn't clear. I mean, if you're thinking of it from a growth perspective, then clearly it would be that the Fed would be more dovish, at least temporarily. But with inflation having such a high priority right now, with these supply bottlenecks as intense as they are, if we were to get another big wave and it created a new round of inflation issues as the Delta wave did over the summer, then it's not even clear that the implication with respect to monetary policy would be to slow the Fed down. It might have very little implication at the margin, or you could even draw up a scenario where the Fed might have to move at the margin even a little bit faster than it would have otherwise, because the inflation pressures intensify in a way that the Fed wasn't expecting.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think you're putting your finger on a battle between potentially conflicting implications that's happening right now, certainly in the inflation markets. On the one hand, as you're pointing out, Stephen, reduced economic activity you could view as softer demand, but then we've also seen the virus contribute to tight labor markets, supply bottlenecks, which have been inflationary. I guess for the time being, it seems like the lower level of break-evens in the TIPS market suggests that the demand side of the argument may be winning, but I do agree with you that we still have, you know, plenty of things we have to see play out. So I want to remind listeners that we have time, plenty of time for questions, and that there is a chat feature on the right side of your webinar screen that you can use to submit questions, and I would encourage you to do that. We've got some excellent speakers today. And in fact, we're getting a first question coming in, and this is for you, Dr. Factor. So this questioner is asking about the vaccines, which, at least according to the sources this questioner has heard from, they don't seem to be stopping infection, and even the CDC and the NIH suggest that the viral load is the same in vaccinated and unvaccinated people. So the question is, how does that square with the importance of vaccination to dampen the risk of future variants?
I'm not sure why we have such a disagreement about the basic facts. Just to be very clear, in the hospitals right now, the majority of patients who come in with COVID are people who have not been vaccinated. It is true that there are people who've been vaccinated and they get a much less severe disease. That is 100% true. The thing that's nice about that is that the people who are vaccinated and get less severe disease also seem to spread it less frequently and suffer it for a shorter period. They are spreading less volume of virus if they're getting it, and they are spreading it for fewer days. So those are for people who are breaking through. During the period right after vaccination, right within that first 6 month period, many people are protected against infection. If you recall the Israeli data, if you recall, Israel got access to the Pfizer vaccine much before everybody. They really put a tremendous effort in vaccinating their population, and they really didn't see breakthrough cases until the Delta variant came along last summer. And then once they started using the booster, we saw a lot of the infections go down. And so currently, we believe that you are very well protected against infection, all infection, for the first few months after vaccination. And then as your immunity wanes, you may well get a breakthrough infection, but again, you will spread it to far fewer people than you otherwise would, because you don't produce the amount of virus and you shed it for a shorter period of time.
Okay. Another question has come in, and I guess this is a little bit of I'm not sure Monday morning is the right word, but let's call it Monday morning quarterbacking. Thinking about the way that the U.S. and I guess countries across the globe have handled this pandemic so far, what would you consider some of the key lessons learned? What could we have done better?
Monday morning quarterbacking. Okay, so luckily for me, I was the original SARS outbreak. I was the team lead for Taiwan, and one thing that happened there during the first outbreak that was in 2003, and getting the population to wear masks was easy. Everyone there just put on the mask. There was no question. Nobody fought it. Nobody made it political. It was not a big deal. I don't know how this happened. I really don't. I think that there is something about the American culture that, I don't know, it feels like it's an infringement upon liberty to wear a mask. I have been wearing a mask since my medical training began, right? So I have been I've been taking care of patients with respiratory infections since I've been a doctor, since I was a medical student, and putting on a mask was nothing to me. I would just put it on to protect myself. So I think that one of the big problems was the whole mythology about the mask. So, and I mean that in several ways. I fault the medical professionals for not making clear to the populace that they needed to protect themselves, right? If you recall, we didn't tell people to put on masks initially because we didn't want to scare everybody. Then we told everybody, oh, yeah, put it on so you protect people if you're sick. We all knew that masks would be protective, right? We all knew that. We all did that. We all have to wear masks when we go into rooms of patients who are sick. So I think that a much deeper, swifter reaction in terms of masks, I think that was a really, really big problem. I think that also once everybody was vaccinated and the rate of, and just to be clear, also the whole politicization of it, the fact that it's somehow, you know, like an infringement upon liberty, I don't know how that happened, and that was a huge problem. I think that we knew that the vaccines were effective in under settings in which people were observing many other measures, right? They were social distancing, they were wearing masks, whatever. The vaccine was effective during those measures. We did not know how effective the vaccine was going to be when you opened everything up. And I think that we opened up a little bit too quickly because then we had to pull it back, and that really made everybody quite angry. So I think there was that. I think that, the other big thing that we fail to communicate from a public health perspective is this. It is really hard to do an outbreak investigation, meaning to figure out about a virus at the same time that you're trying to prevent the spread of it. It is really hard figuring out the incubation period, the duration of transmission, all of that. That is hard to figure out at the same time that you're trying to protect people. And then the other thing that I will say is this. When I was in public health school, many of my colleagues were from China. They were smart. They were talented. They were devoted. They were absolutely committed to, you know, they had the best intentions. I do not feel that way about the Chinese government. My experience working with them on outbreaks has been that there is a real lack of transparency and a real lack of collegiality in terms of sharing things. I think that they really hid a lot of stuff at the beginning in a way which we will never know. And then I think that they were, once they reported the infections to the WHO, they then were collaborative about sharing their tests. They were very quick about identifying the type of virus that was causing the outbreak. But if we had other stuff to do, I think the key thing is to, you know, to not politicize simple medical measures, and also I think to always be much more transparent about what we know and what we don't know. I think that's going to be the biggest thing going forward.
Okay, so that's obviously the public policy aspects of the pandemic, I'm sure, will see thousands of policy papers and dissertations for years to come. Let me turn back to the science here. So there's a question of whether science can somehow get ahead of the virus itself. Is it possible then to develop a vaccine that would, if I'm getting to the question, that would be effective against likely mutations? In other words, a vaccine that would anticipate the direction of the virus's evolution.
So that is a brilliant idea, and I really invite you to come try that. We have never been able to, it's brilliant. No, we've never been able to do that. So what we usually do, just to be clear, what we usually try to do, right, is in any given virus, there are the regions that mutate a lot, and there are regions that try to, that often stay the same. In the flu vaccine, I'm just going to talk about flu for a quick second. Flu has portions which really change rapidly and then portions which are pretty stable. We have been very, very, very ineffective at trying to get the immune system to recognize the portions of the flu virus that remain stable. There's currently one and that's being tested. It was actually developed by folks at Sinai, which is why I know about it. But, you know, hopefully the idea of a universal flu vaccine is that you develop a vaccine that encourages humans to recognize the portion that's really conserved, the part that doesn't change from strain to strain. You know, I am going to be honest and tell you that I do not know everything that there is to know about coronaviruses. I believe that everybody thought that the spike protein was absolutely key to infection, right? It's the spike protein that recognizes the receptor on the cell. And so the idea was develop a vaccine that goes against the spike protein. The predicting how the spike protein will change and evolve is, I don't know how we do not have the assays to do that. The only other thing I would say is this. You know, one can go into a lab and start mutating the virus. You can, although you're not actually allowed to do that for obvious reasons. You could go and do that, let's say. You could go and mutate it. You have no idea why you're sitting and mutating it. You could make it grow, you know, in vitro in a million and one ways, but what the virus will actually do in humans, you never know, right? It could no longer cause infection, which would be great. Then you'd like vaccinate everybody with a new version that doesn't actually cause a disease, right? It causes infection, but no disease. The other thing that could happen is you could develop a virus that kills humans so quickly. Jeremy, you could develop a virus that's incredibly, incredibly deadly. So we don't allow people to do that type of work because of the wide range of possibilities, and we don't have assays to predict what the virus will do, and we have no idea of knowing from a virus that's just in a petri dish how well it's going to do in humans.
Okay, so a great ambition, but not within reach at this point. So here's another question we're getting that I'm not sure I've heard before. So this listener is saying many of us have received three vaccinations already. There's potentially more rounds to come. Is there a risk of over-vaccination or some kind of diminishing antibodies?
Great question. There does not seem to be. There are, as everyone knows, you all need to get your tetanus booster every 10 years. There's no danger in getting your tetanus booster every 10 years, right? For the Pneumovax vaccine, on the other hand, you get your Pneumovax vaccine and then you get a repeat at 5 years. And currently, it does not look like it's a good idea to get any after that, although some experts are suggesting that you do. But for most vaccines that we've seen, I can't think of any other instance in which there's too much of a good thing. I really can't think of any. It does not appear what vaccines do. I'm just reminding you all what vaccines do is they basically, you know, serve your body on this like beautiful silver platter. They say, here it is. This is other. Recognize other. Look at it. Here it is. I'm screaming to you. Recognize this as other. And so far it does not appear at all to be told that several times is dangerous. It appears as though that's actually very helpful.
So related to that, there's a question we're getting about the protection that you get from vaccines compared to the protection you'd get from a naturally occurring infection. Is there a combination of vaccines and natural infection that produce different immunity results?
Okay, so this is a great question. So just specifically with the coronavirus, it appears as though vaccination provides you with much longer lasting immunity than natural infection. So with the coronavirus, it's very clear right now. In multiple studies, it's been shown that vaccines are far superior. And this makes sense. I'll explain. As you all know, coronaviruses cause the common cold, and it is not unusual for, like, a cold to be passed around a family, right? So the kid comes home from elementary school, shares the cold, it transmits through the other kids and then the parents, and then it starts back with the kid again. And that's because in a normal season with a normal coronavirus, your immunity is short-lived. I mean, people suggest it's around 90 days. I'm not, I don't know for a cold vaccine if it even is that long. And so within a single season, you can be infected with coronavirus multiple times. So, right now, it really appears as though the vaccines are far superior for this particular, for coronavirus. I believe, for example, for measles, natural immunity is superior. So I think it might be on a disease basis, but for coronaviruses, it's fairly clear. Vaccines are superior.
Okay, fabulous. Well, I think by and large, we've been able to cover at least most of the major questions or related questions that we've gotten from our listeners today. We're kind of quickly running out of time, and we do appreciate how long everybody has held on. So I want to thank our guests, Dr. Stephanie Factor, Associate Professor of Medicine and Infectious Disease at the Mount Sinai Hospital, as well as my colleague and Chief Economist here at Amherst Pierpont, Stephen Stanley. We should have a recording available of this call in the next day or so. I'm Steve Abrahams. Thanks for listening again today, and please keep an eye out for all of the APS strategy that comes your way every week. Thanks again for dialing in, and have a great afternoon.